most of the last 3 weeks in those two classic cities where the foundations of Western civilization were first forged, Jerusalem and Athens. Jeremiah preached the word of the Lord in Jerusalem. Socrates sought a definition of virtue among the citizens of Athens. Ezra proclaimed the Torah in Jerusalem, and Plato wrote the dialogues in Athens. I went to Jerusalem to work, if any trip to Jerusalem can be called work. I escorted there and guided three of my ministerial colleagues from Cleveland as part of an ongoing program which attempts to make them more aware and sensitive to those issues in the Middle East which are of such vital concern to us. And I went to Athens for renewal and relief, what we used to call in the service R&R, relief from the routine, from the telephone, from the weather. And as I walked out in these two great cities, I thought of all that we owed to them and of what they are today, and it's that intermingling of past and present, of significance and challenge, that I'd like to reflect on with you this morning. It used to be a commonplace among teachers and educators that civilization began in Jerusalem and in Athens. Now, in these latter years, we've become a little less parochial, and we know that civilization owes as much to Baghdad and to Cairo, to Benares and to Bombay, to Peking and to Canton, as it does to Jerusalem and Athens. But it remains true that anyone who wants to master the disciplines of theater, or philosophy, architecture, poetry, of human nature, psychology, religion, has to go back and begin with the contributions of those people who lived in these two cities in antiquity. Essayists and thinkers throughout the long ages have pondered the specific weight to be given to the contribution of Jerusalem to Athens. We often use the word civilization as if civilization was a single thing, a coherent unit. But in fact, civilization is no more than the sum of the accomplishments of the human mind, of the human spirit to date. And those accomplishments are obviously not of a single purpose. They do not assume a single position or a single definition of right or truth or beauty. And the attitude, the approach which was taken in ancient Athens, the attitude and the approach which was dominant in ancient Jerusalem were very different. And men have been debating the respective values to be assigned to those differences ever since. For example, the Athenians in their great period of civilization, 6th, 5th, 4th centuries before the Common Era, had a unique talent for beauty. Beauty fascinated them. Their hands could create things of beauty. And their minds sought for a definition of beauty, for those proportions, that harmony, that balance, the numerical relationship between objects which would somehow define, describe the beautiful. And when you are in Athens, you sense their capacity to produce the beautiful. Above you, wherever you walk, is the Acropolis crowned by the Parthenons. And when you make a visit to the National Museum of Athens, you, at almost every turn, you're astounded by a classic bronze statue of great beauty, classic lines, by some totally beautifully done and inscribed black vases, red vases, and the like. Athens produced beauty, and thought about beauty, and had a talent for beauty. By contrast, when you visit the Israel Museum in Jerusalem, you are struck by the historical importance of so many of the objects you see, but there's no object before which you come on and which suddenly takes your breath away. I know in Jerusalem of no native tradition of architecture, of art, which made a major or significant contribution to those disciplines. Jerusalem borrowed its art forms. And its art forms were common and ordinary. They were not unique and special and classic. Now, perhaps this lack of talent for art, who knows, was part of the reason that our people came to the understanding of the God who could not be given shape or representation. That God was something more than the physical symbol. God was beyond representation, and therefore beyond myth, one spirit and not flesh. You know that there's no achievement in human nature which does not have some kind of compensatory disability or disadvantage attached to it. And this is true even with a sense of the beautiful. The Athenians obviously had developed a highly discriminating eye. They could see the differences between the superior and the inferior in quality, in line, in shape, in creation. And very often it seems as if their eye stopped with the object and their mind ceased once it had made these judgments that were discriminating in nature. There was always something superior, better, and there was always something inferior, less good, worse. And they took this sense of the superior and the inferior and they applied it to their gods, they applied it to human beings. There was always a superior people, the Hellenes, the Greeks, and there were always inferior people, the others, the barbarians, a word which they coined from their word barbaros, which means the apes. They somehow were never able to go beyond this discriminating sense to that sense of community, of coherence, which seems to have been the unique capacity of Jerusalem. That sense which allowed Jerusalemites to see that which bound all things together. Not one people of superior, one superior person, one inferior person, one superior race, one inferior race. Oh yes, there were Jews and non-Jews, but all were children of the one God. It was in Jerusalem that the concept of humanity was forged. It was in Jerusalem that the concept of the unity of God was first proclaimed to man. And the sense of unity is essentially one in which you go beyond, you transcend these questions of taste, of discrimination. And you see that which is in a sense, which is art, which is whether it is inferior or superior, better or worse. And you see that which binds all men together, whether we are superior or less than superior in our talents and in our persons and our achievements. Now, when men have discussed the relative achievements of Athens and of Jerusalem, they've been fascinated by the fact that these two great cities, or rather the citizens of these cities, or rather those who thought about these matters among the citizens of those cities, that these people went about the business of thinking, of judgment, of discriminating values in a totally different way, or seemingly in a totally different way. In Athens, there was a love of reason, of logic, of deduction, of classification. Things had to be put in order, into mathematical formulation. There was experience, and you tried to infer from experience to general propositions. This was the learning of the mind. This is what was cultivated in Athens. And in Jerusalem, they used to say the approach was the interior approach, the subjective approach, the cultivation of the heart and of the spirit, the mystical approach, intuition, revelation, all the things, the means by which the heart expresses our human feelings. Now, this is, of course, this absolute discrimination is an exaggeration. You'll remember that Socrates not only sought the precise definition of justice and of truth and of liberty, but he had a little daemon, a little man who lived in his ear. And whenever he didn't know quite what to do, the little man would speak to him and tell him what to do. No Athenian general ever engaged the enemy in battle before he had consulted the priests, and the priests had offered a sacrifice, and they'd look to the heavens for some augury, for some indication from the gods as to whether the day was propitious or not for the battle. There was a demonic, there was a dark, there was a Dionysian side to Athenian civilization. And there was a rational, logical, philosophic side to Judean, Jerusalemite civilization. The book of Job is, after all, a dialogue, almost a Platonic dialogue, on the meaning, the definition of providence. The book of Ecclesiastes in the Bible is the reflections of a gentle cynic, a philosopher, on the nature of life. The law is essentially reasonable. That is, it deals with sociological phenomena in a reasonable and constructive and socially significant way. There was an emphasis, an understanding of reason in Jerusalem. There was an understanding of the darks, the deep interior life of man in Athens. And yet, when all is said and done, Jerusalem produced no Aristotle, and Athens produced no Jeremiah. There was something essentially different in the basic approach of these two great cities, these two great civilizations, to truth, to meaning, to knowledge. And you think of all of this as you walk through these ancient cities, their past glories, and all that their approaches to learning have, and all that their wisdom and literature have meant and continue to mean to modern man. But as you do, you recognize that it's not simply a matter of books, of contributions to civilization, of learning. It's not simply a matter of the theoretical importance one ascribes to a particular subjective or objective reasoning or insightful approach to truth. After all, these two great civilizations came into conflict, came into contact with one another in the fourth and third centuries before the Common Era. In the sixth pre-Christian century, you recall the East, the Persians, Darius, Xerxes, tried to conquer Greece. And they were repelled by Athens, by a league of Greek cities led by Athens at Marathon and Salamis. And about two centuries later, the Greeks returned the compliment. And the Greeks conquered the Middle East under Alexander of Macedon. And with that conquest, which was successful in that Greek civilization, Greek ways became the dominant ways in the Middle East for several hundred years, all manner of Hellenistic attitudes, values, art forms, architectural forms, city planning, all these spread throughout the Middle East. Jerusalem, which, like every other city of that part of the world, became part of Alexander's empire and then part of the empires of his generals, began to be reshaped with a Greek dress. There was a hippodrome in Jerusalem in the third century. There was a theater in Jerusalem in the second century. There was a gymnasium in Jerusalem in the second century. Jerusalem began to look like a Greek city. As a matter of fact, the great temple of Jerusalem began to have a Greek face. There were Corinthian columns in front of the Holy of Holies. And there was a great Doric stoa around the Temple Mount. But as much as the dress of Greek civilization was accepted in that part of the world, much was unacceptable. When we look up today at the Acropolis and see the Parthenon, it looks so chaste. There it is, white, the marble and the granite all fusing together, wind-bleached by the ages. It's simple. Much of it is no longer there. And it's hard to remind ourselves, because we really don't want to remind ourselves, that in its pristine, in its mint condition, that the Parthenon was colored black and red and blue, it must have been quite garish. And though every space in that great temple that was flat was covered with sculpture, with friezes of one kind or another, which were individually quite magnificent, but taken together and painted in gaudy colors as they were, must have seemed almost overwhelming. And the roof was filled with brightly colored tiles, and on top of the roof there were piled gargoyles and winged victories and Nikes, all manner of things going up in the air here and there. The simplicity of line, the colorlessness, which so appeals to the modern spirit, was absent in the original building. There was a complexity, a darkness, which might not have appealed to us. And when the Greek world came and spread its civilization, in quotation marks, above the civilization of the Middle East, those who lived in the Middle East saw not only the brilliance of some of its art and theater and architecture, but some of the darkness, some of the things it didn't accept in its religion, its morals, and its values. You all know the story of Hanukkah. Hanukkah is essentially a holiday which celebrates the rejection by the Jews of Greek values. Not only in what we know it to be, that is, the rejection by the Jews of the determination of a Syrian Greek emperor to set up in the temple a statue of Zeus Olympius, but the rejection by the mass of Judeans, of Jerusalemites, the whole series of values which were becoming part and parcel of the way of life of the elite, of the few who led the Judean community. Jewish modesty was affronted by the nakedness of the athletes competing in their games. Jewish sexual morality was affronted by the homosexuality of Greek culture, by the willingness of Greek parents to expose a crippled or deformed or unwanted child simply because it was not perfectly shaped, by the indifference of the Greek culture to the sanctity of family vows, marriage vows. The Jewish spirit was affronted by the martial quality of education of the young in Athens and elsewhere. There was so much in the Greek culture which Jews found repellent, including, surprisingly, the materialism, the mercantilism of the Greek culture. Jerusalem in the 3rd century, in the 2nd century, was essentially an agrarian community. It was a city supported by a countryside. Most of the people who lived in the city were also farmers, vintners, the people of this type. Jews had not become the great urban people we have been in the last several millennia. And if you look into the literature of the rabbis from those early days, you'll find a whole series of vignettes which begin, an Athenian merchant came to Jerusalem. And what follows is a story in which a shrewd, over-shrewd merchant, an Athenian, he personifies the merchant class, comes with his worldly wisdom to Jerusalem, and he is defeated by the simple, rural wisdom of a Jew, of a Jerusalemite. So Judaism accepted some of the outward forms, the architecture, the poetic forms, the philosophic literature of the of Greece, but rejected many of the values which were implicit within the urban life of ancient Athens. By contrast, ancient Athens proved to be absolutely disinterested, blind, if you will, to the achievements of the Jewish spirit. The Bible was translated into Greek around the year 280 before the Common Era. This is the famous Septuagint translation. For the next 400 years, there is not a single indication that a single Greek scholar, single Athenian, ever read the Bible. They were simply disinterested in the civilization of this conquered people. Imperial powers are relatively fascinated by, interested in, willing to look for the truth, for the wisdom of a people that they have subjugated. You'll find in the 3rd, 2nd, 1st century literature of Athens, perhaps half a dozen references to Moses. Most of them are misinformed. Clearly, none of these men has ever read the Torah. They know of Moses as the lawgiver of the Jews, the way that Solon is known as the lawgiver of Athens, or Lycurgus as the lawgiver of Sparta. But none of the facts of that they recite conform to what we know to be the stories that's given to us in the Torah. And there is simply no indication in Greek literature that there was ever a real interest, fascination with the attitudes, the approaches, the values of our people. And so the impact, the cultural impact of Athens and Jerusalem was real, but the cultural impact of Jerusalem and Athens had to wait many centuries until Christianity brought a diluted form of Jerusalem culture to bear in the Greek world. Now that's the antiquity. That's the past. Anyone who visits these great cities brings with him his reading of Plato or Herodotus, of Jeremiah, of Ezra, and he thinks of these ancient approaches, this truth, these values, these contributions to civilization. But the city he walks out into is a very different place. Athens is a great, crowded metropolis, 3 million people. You take your life in your hands when you cross a street in Athens. The traffic is among the worst I've seen any place in this world. A constant pall of smog hovers over the city. You can see it as you fly in. You cough as you get up in the morning. When you climb to the top of the Acropolis, you understand not only that this cloud is sitting just about there at the height of the Acropolis, but that the archaeologists are concerned that the smog is eating away into the mortar, into the joints which hold the lintels of the building upright on their pedestals. It's a crowded city. It's a noisy city. It's a modern city with all of the accomplishments and all of the failings of modern civilization. It's not a city of great beauty. Jerusalem is a smaller city. It's a city perhaps a ninth or a tenth the size of Athens. It's a prettier city. City which is still visually bound together by the rose-colored hue of the stone from which most of the buildings are made. The buildings are low. They spread out over the countryside, over the hillsides, outside the ancient walls. There's very little industry in Jerusalem. There's an industrial park now in East Jerusalem on the far outskirts. There's an airport in East Jerusalem. But Jerusalem has up till now escaped many of the worst facets for living beings of a modern city. When you walk out into these two cities, what do you think about? Well, what I thought about was the contrast between Athens, Jerusalem, and Cleveland. I brought Cleveland, as I must, to these two classic communities. And I was struck by many of the seemingly improbable contrasts. What is Cleveland, little Cleveland, nondescript Cleveland, to do with these two classic cities? Well, the contrast is not as far-fetched as it seems. Each of these three cities, ours, Jerusalem, and Athens, is a modern city. Each began to grow at about the same time. In 1850, 125 years ago, Athens was a small village of about 5,000 people who lived in huts just on the side of the Acropolis. In 1850, about 17,000 Arabs and Jews bounced around in the old city of Jerusalem. In 1850, there were, 35,000 settled in Cleveland, down around the public square and the near west side. Almost all that you see in Cleveland and Athens and in Jerusalem was built there in the last 125 years. The pattern of growth is the timing of the growth, patterns of growth are similar. But what a contrast. Cleveland is a city without a past. Like Topsy, we just grew. And we gave no thought to the past. We left one settlement, we came someplace else, we forgot about what we left behind. It's a city without a heart, it's a city without a center, as well as a city without a past. By contrast, Jerusalem and Athens cannot escape their past. Cleveland exists because here was a convenient place to wed the coal and the iron ore and the lime and create steel. Cleveland exists because here was a place in which the basic industry of the nation could be developed, the economic sinews forged. We're an economic creation of economic necessity. And the city reflects its economic base. We measure growth in Cleveland, if I read the press correctly, by whether or not a corporation moves in or a corporation moves out. That's the measure of growth. In Athens and in Jerusalem, the measure of growth is simply how true are we to the glories of our past? Have we lived up to the inheritance which was given us by our ancestors? The questions are different, and therefore the answers that they come to are very different. Wherever you walk in Athens, you can look up and you can see the Acropolis. In Jerusalem, you can't always see the walls of the old city. You certainly can't always see the Western Wall, but you're always conscious of their presence and never far away from you. And as a result, whatever that city does is done with an eye to its past. In Athens, the great boulevards which go east and west in the new cities will suddenly detour because there's an important medieval Byzantine church or some columns which were raised in the temple by Hadrian. You can't simply go through these ancient shrines and temples simply because modern engineers tell you that's the best way for the traffic to flow. In Cleveland, you build right through, under, over, anything that you want, because nothing has a history which is truly significant to us. But it's more than a matter of archaeology. Athens and Jerusalem have been resurrected not because they were economically desirable locations for modern industry. There is very little industry in Jerusalem. Piraeus, the port, is a much more economically useful place than the city of Athens itself. They came into being because they were symbols to two great people of their national renewal. In the 16th century, Greece fell under the sway of Turkey. And Turkish rule of Greece was brutal and harsh and cruel. And the Greeks wanted, throughout these generations, their independence. And when, after long decades of battle early in the 19th century, they finally won their independence, there was only one place where they could put their capital, in Athens, within sight of the ancient glory which represented the glory of Greece, the Greece which had repelled the ancestors of the Turks, the Persians. And the same is with Jerusalem. Jerusalem exists as Jerusalem because in the ancient world there was an important tollway that went from Hebron to Bethlehem to Jerusalem to Samaria and then up to the Galilee. That modern tollway is today economically meaningless. Jerusalem was resurrected because Jerusalem was significant to the Zionist movement, the Shana Haba Yerushalayim, next year in Jerusalem. Zionism, without the resurrection of Jerusalem, would have been meaningless. Here was the site of the temple. Here was the very center, symbolic center of Jewish spiritual and Jewish national renewal. So both these cities represent to their respective nations the renewal of their vital energies, the renewal of their independence. And so the great university is in Jerusalem, the Hebrew University. The great university is in Athens, the University of Athens. The great museums are in Athens and Jerusalem. The government is centered in Athens and Jerusalem. There is the kinds of people who are drawn, the exciting people, the people of great talent, who are drawn to the places where power and civilization and culture survive. These people throng in Jerusalem and throng in Athens and give it a very special color. But the past is both a measure, a standard, and it is a burden. We can make decisions and no one really cares. Cleveland is one of those cities in the world which will grow up in a century and disappear in a century. It has no basic role to play in the history of the great things of the world. But that's not true of Jerusalem, and it's not true of Athens. And because of the sense of the past, both Athens and Jerusalem are burdened by a responsibility to that past, and particularly burdened by those who believe themselves to be the guardians of the past. I don't know how many of you have ever visited the Heichal Shlomo in Jerusalem. It's a great granite building about a block or two from the King David Hotel, which is the center of the chief rabbinate. If you walk into the building, you'll find that you come into the council chambers, which look as if they were the parliament of some minor nation. In Israel, the Orthodox rabbinate, as you know, has gained control of the laws of personal status, has demanded that the country conform to the traditional calendar, the traditional Sabbath, many of the traditional attitudes, and has a definite political role in the life of the community. It considers itself to be the guardian of the glories of the past. And if Jerusalem is to be true to its traditions, it must be true to their definition of that past. And in Greece, the same role is played by the ecclesiastics, the ministers, and the bishops, the priests of the Greek Orthodox Church. The Greek Church is a national church. It's part of what is called the Orthodox Catholic tradition, that it is Catholic in doctrine, but it does not recognize the primacy of the Roman Catholic Pope. It considers itself to be the people, they consider themselves to be the people who have inherited the mantle of the tradition. Like the rabbinate in Israel, the control in Greece, all actions which involve marriage and divorce and adoption and inheritance. If you're a Christian, you cannot be married in Greece unless a Greek Orthodox priest marries you. The same way as in Israel, you cannot be married unless an Orthodox rabbi performs the ceremony. Just as the rabbinate in Israel has been politicized, so the Greek Orthodox Church has been politicized. Now, both these traditions are part and parcel, obviously, of the past. And they involve their respective nations in the whole movement of national liberation, which begins as a religious as well as a secular phenomenon. In Greece, when you visit one of their historical museums and you see pictures of all the men who fought in the 1810s and 20s and 30s against the Turks, you'll find a large number of pictures of bishops and priests of the Greek Orthodox Church who were martyrs to that struggle for national liberation. Just as the Mizrahi, the Orthodox community, was involved in the Zionist movement, so the Greek Orthodox tradition was involved in their own national movement. This creates a problem of which we in Cleveland are innocent and unaware. And that is that for those who really care about their national spirit, who want their city, Athens, Jerusalem, to amount to something, to be of the past and of the present and significant for the future, they must somehow come to grips with these guardians of the tradition. And they must somehow, they cannot simply do what we do, which is to say, we'll let the Orthodox live as they want to live, and we'll live as we want to live, and we don't have to adjust the whole into a truly coherent community. That option is not available to them. And so in both Athens and Jerusalem, there are groups of people, academics, intellectuals, creative people, who are trying to wrestle through the problem of how to deal with what must be called a politically reactionary religious authority. It's a very difficult problem, because much of what that religious authority stands for is good and valid and insightful and desirable and relevant. But at the same time, many of the ways in which they try to apply to enforce their way of life upon a community are no longer tolerable in a democratic and free society. No one wants to be coerced or forced into a particular form of marriage, into a particular form of adoption. And by chance, we happen to meet in Jerusalem and in Athens with men coming from the academic world of their respective communities who had almost identical responses to the problems which they faced. In Jerusalem one night, we met with a group which is called the Rainbow Group. It's a group of Christian clergy, members of the Hebrew University, some liberal Jewish thinkers and liberal rabbis, who've been meeting now for about 15 years to discuss issues of common concern. After the meeting was over, I sat down and had coffee with a man by the name of Zev Falk. Zev Falk is a professor of family law at the Hebrew University. He's a believing Jew. He's an observant Jew. He's a Jew who's terribly troubled by the pressures being used by the Orthodox rabbin in Israel to coerce people to follow in their way. He said essentially this to me. They're learned men, but their learning is not the learning which is conventional in our day. They've lost the ability to talk to a whole section of our society. They are people who are convinced that they can force others by political power to do what they want them to do, and not simply lead them towards their way by example or by sweet reason or by in some other kind of non-coercive form. He said they've become increasingly politicized, increasingly dangerous, and it's becoming increasingly difficult for those of us who know that Jerusalem must be a city which represents the best in the Jewish spirit, which weds in a very integral and coherent way the past and the present, to come to some kind of understanding of what that present should be, because they are pushing away from us more and more our youth, who see only the coercion, only the medievalism, only the insistence on traditions which are not central to our religious affirmations. About a week later, I happened to have dinner with a man who is professor of theology at the University of Athens. His name is Nisiatis. He's a very interesting man, a man in his late 50s, learned. He's met a number of the leaders of the Jewish community. He has visited Israel and has some very positive feelings about Israel. But we talked more about Greece than about Israel. And he said to me essentially what Falk had said. I believe in my tradition. I am burdened, constantly badgered in my teaching. My theology faculty is being badgered in its teaching by the bishops of the Greek Orthodox Church, who insist that we must talk of the tradition as if it is only the tradition of the medieval church, that we must see the non-essential as if it were essential and demand there be full compliance, not simply a compliance to that which is central and coherent, basic to our tradition. They're driving away the young. They're driving them to a form of secularism which will ultimately destroy the very special quality of life here in Athens and in Greece, because it will allow Athens and Greece to become just another ordinary, modern, industrial community. And I said, that sounds like Cleveland. And he said, I don't know Cleveland. But if Cleveland is like so many of the cities in Europe, that's exactly what I'm saying. Zev Falk in Jerusalem and Nisiotis in Athens are fighting the struggle to give a very special quality, a sense of the integrity of the past, the fusion of the past and the present to life in their communities so that it can, their communities can expand and unfold and in fact be what a city must be. Av v'eim, a father and a mother. Ir v'eim, a city and a mother. Phrases from our tradition. Place where civilization occurs. For civilization, as you remember, is a word which comes from city, civitas. It is the culture of a city. I don't know what contributions Cleveland has made to civilization. I do know something of the contributions which Athens and Jerusalem have made to civilization. I know that the Falks and the Ciotes of their respective communities are working as best they can to see to it that in the future, their cities will make significant contributions. And perhaps in our own way, we can find some way to turn the blast furnaces and the streets of Cleveland, even Cleveland, into a place in which civilization, significance, which means uniqueness, which means distinction, which means not being like every other industrial megalopolis in the world, which means being a place where decisions are made because they will add to the grace with which human life is led, which means a place in which we will judge the strength of the community, not by how many corporate headquarters exist here, but by how many men and women whose heads are filled with ideas live here, and what they're accomplishing here, and how much we're willing to support them, to participate with them in that accomplishment. It was an interesting trip. And despite the snow, I'm glad to be home. And if you want to see the contrast between Cleveland and two of the great cities of the world, go to Athens and go to Jerusalem. Particularly go to Jerusalem. Spend some time there, not in early January when the weather is cold and snow can fall in Athens, as I discovered, but early spring or summer, and walk the streets and think a little bit about the past with the guidebook in your hand. But think about the present, about what these cities are struggling to become and perhaps what our city should struggle, can struggle to become. Amen.